Welcome to the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Ahead this hour, the mission of the Milton Hershey School is to help lift at-risk youth out of poverty, but a controversial college scholarship program is leaving some in debt. We'll also catch up to longtime Philadelphia sports journalist Ray Dinger about some of the great sports stories of the last 50 years. But first, we take a look at the Supreme Court's decision in Fulton versus City of Philadelphia. On Thursday, the High Court decided in favor of Catholic Social Services in a dispute in which the city had ended its long-standing contract with the agency because CSS, citing religious beliefs, wouldn't consider working with same-sex couples as foster parents. To the surprise of many, the finding in favor of Catholic Social Services was supported by all nine justices. But the decision is narrow in scope and somewhat ambiguous, focusing primarily on an anti-discrimination clause in the city's contract with CSS, leading observers on both sides of the issue to wonder about its wider application. Our guest to begin the show is Katie Iyer, a law professor at Rutgers Camden. Iyer is an anti-discrimination scholar on behalf of LGBTQ and disabled employees. Katie Iyer, welcome.
Thank you, Mary. It's a pleasure to be here.
So what was your immediate reaction to the ruling?
So I think Fulton is a case that to the sort of surface appearances looks like a very narrow case. Some of the reporting has described it as a case that went out with a whimper rather than a bang. But if you go deeper into the many pages of opinions, what you find is that it actually provides us with a series of really important signposts about where the Supreme Court is likely to go in the area of free exercise doctrine. And those signposts actually point in the area of significant change and significant alterations to the doctrine that we are likely to see in the upcoming years. So I actually think it's a much more important case than the narrow holding might suggest at first glance.
Okay, and I'd like to get to those signposts in just a moment. But first, if you could explain what the justices focused on in the city's anti-discrimination policy that led them to determine Philly's actions were unconstitutional.
Sure. So a little bit of backdrop here. Under current free exercise doctrine, the law says that where a law is generally applicable and neutral, that it generally isn't going to command significant scrutiny in the courts, even where it substantially burdens religion. So under a decision called Employment Division versus Smith, the court has said government generally can enforce its neutral and generally applicable laws, even though that might burden religion exercise in some context. In this particular case, however, they found that because of the nature of the contract provision, it was an anti-discrimination provision that then had a broad standardless exemption. It said that the commissioner could, within their sole discretion, decide to grant exemptions to the anti-discrimination provision. They found that that made the anti-discrimination provision not neutral and generally applicable. Specifically, they found it made it not generally applicable because it was something that could be granted exemptions on a case-by-case basis. That meant that they applied a lot more scrutiny to what the city did here than if it were a blanket prohibition on discrimination. And they found that the city just couldn't justify applying that much higher level of scrutiny why they would not grant an exemption to CSS in the context of the very specific facts of this case, where there's lots of other potential agencies through which couples could be certified and have foster children placed in their homes.
So the city's response to this in part says, despite the challenges posed by the ruling, we will continue to care for our city's foster care youth, including in partnership with Catholic Social Services. And the city goes on to say it will continue to protect and include all Philadelphians, including LGBTQ youth and families, while recognizing and respecting the Supreme Court's ruling. So it seems as if it's going to, you know, continue with its relationship with Catholic Social Services. At the same time, you know, conservative Justice Samuel Alito wrote that, you know, if the city wants to get around today's decision, Thursday's decision, it can simply eliminate the never used exemption power. Is it relatively easy for Philadelphia to change its policy around exemptions in this case, Katie? And why does it seem as if they decided not to go this route without actually having spoken to them?
Well, so this is where I think the signposts in the decision become important. So if you look at the concurring opinions in the case, putting those concurring opinions together, you have at least five and maybe six justices that have articulated the view that they are prepared to overrule the Smith decision, which generally has allowed governments to proceed with their neutral and generally applicable laws, enforcing those even in religious contexts without meaningful scrutiny. So this is a 1990 case that had rolled back some prior free exercise doctrine that had given more scrutiny to government actions, even where they might be in the context of a law that applies to everyone, and had said, no, we're really going to be hands-off where government has generally applicable law. In the context of Fulton, if you look at the various decisions, we have five justices who have now signaled pretty clearly that they don't think that this Smith decision was rightly decided, and that there should be contexts where even generally applicable laws are going to receive more scrutiny where they're applied in the context of religious free exercise. So I actually think it's a very smart move on the part of the city to not simply try to play the game of retracting the ability to grant exemptions from the contract, and to recognize more globally that the court is signaling where it may be going, and that it wants cities, other public entities, to be thoughtful about how they apply generally applicable law, particularly if you look at some of the current concurrences in the context of entities like CSS that are, you know, effectively an arm of the Catholic Church.
So in court filings, Katie Iyer, CSS said it has never been approached by a same-sex couple for employment as foster parents. And if this had happened, they'd simply refer them to another agency which had contracted with the city. So as the old arrangement continues, do you see potential harm to foster kids in the system?
You know, I think that there is a potential for harm both to foster parents and to foster kids wherever you allow entities that are contracting with the city to engage in discrimination, right? This is not just about the potential for discrimination against foster parents, right? You know, if you're thinking about the kids who CSS may be placing, there are some of those kids who may be best placed with a foster parent who is themselves LGBT. And insofar as their policy would prohibit that, there could be real harm to those kids as well as to the parents who might be turned away. I do think that, you know, this is a circumstance in which the potential harms of discrimination don't look quite as severe as if you were in geographically, for example, another part of the country where religious entities might dominate foster care placements. Mm-hmm. But nevertheless, there is still the potential for harm there. So that's something that the city is going to have to figure out how to navigate and how to best ensure that neither foster children, who are among, of course, our most vulnerable kids, nor foster parents are, you know, harmed or excluded by virtue of CSS's policies.
Let's talk some more about your take on how the Supreme Court in recent years has been looking at cases in specific involving religious organizations. The High Court has been sympathetic to these groups in a number of cases, but in some, like Fulton, you know, and the Colorado cake baker case, justices seem to be avoiding decisions that are sweeping in nature. I mean, granted, if they decide to overturn Employment Division versus Smith, that's going to have a sweeping effect on a number of cases. But what is your take about the narrow decisions made in Fulton and Colorado cake baker?
So it's always dangerous to speculate about what may be going on in the justices' minds, but I do think you're right that the court's approach in both of these cases signals that they did not want to make sweeping pronouncements in the context of the facts of the cases before them. And if I had to speculate, I'd say that's because they don't view those cases as perhaps typical of the types of circumstances that would lead to good, generally applicable doctrine for the free exercise area. you know, we've reached this point where people are very focused on the perceived conflict between LGBT anti-discrimination rights and religious practice. But the reality is that most of free exercise doctrine is not concerned with that set of issues, right? There's a very broad and rich tradition of religious accommodation in our country that is entirely unconnected to the area of anti-discrimination law. Anti-discrimination law is in many ways the most difficult area for consideration of questions of religious accommodation. There's many other areas where the harms that might exist are trivial or non-existent. So, for example, there's a case pending cert, I believe still right now, that addresses whether somebody has to submit a social security number in order to be a contractor under state law, where their religion would interfere with that. And there are other ways to verify their identity. Yeah. And I think that the court perhaps properly is recognizing that we don't want to create our general principles for free exercise doctrine to the extent the court's going to be looking at moving away from Smith in the context that prevents the sort of most difficult, most thorny set of questions, as opposed to the more routine applications of where government ought to be considering granting accommodation for religious beliefs and religious practice.
At the end of the day, though, what needs to happen overall in the big picture to balance the rights of LGBTQ people and the Constitution's guarantee of free exercise of religion? Broadly speaking, Katie Iyer, is it possible to dovetail these rights without either side compromising their closely held beliefs?
So I think where the court will ultimately take us with respect to that remains unclear at this time. I don't think that they've given us the final word on where they are heading with that set of issues. But I think that we can, putting together their decisions, come to some conclusions. I think that first, it's clear that they don't view discrimination, religiously motivated discrimination, as entirely valueless in the way that they, in the context of LGBT rights, in the way that they once did with, for example, race discrimination. So I think it's important to recognize that we're not in the context of the set of decisions that the court decided in the 60s, saying basically First Amendment rights don't exist in the context of discrimination. We've moved away from that. But on the other hand, it's also clear that the court does recognize that there are very real government interests at stake in protecting LGBTQ individuals from discrimination. They say that again here in the context of the Fulton decision. And so I think the set of decisions, if I were a city entity looking at these here today, I'd be thinking about the court wants us to be thoughtful and careful in making sure our interests are truly implicated.
We've got about 10 seconds. Sorry about that.
Enforce anti-discrimination law. But on the other hand, that's not a blanket exemption to allow religious entities and individuals to discriminate.
All right, Katie Iyer, professor of law at Rutgers University. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Stay close. The regional roundup continues on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You're listening to the regional roundup on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. For over a century, the Milton Hershey Boarding School has educated at-risk youth free of charge in a mission to help students move out of poverty and into the middle class. Located in Hershey, Pennsylvania, and lavishly funded by stock dividends, which flow from the profits of the Hershey Candy Company, the private school sits on $17 billion in assets and is subject to relatively little government oversight. And while a great many of its graduates treasure their time spent at the school and say it set them up to succeed, there are others whose paths forward have been rockier, including some left in debt by the Hershey School's college scholarship program. Bob Fernandez reports for the Philadelphia Inquirer, Charlotte Keith for Spotlight PA. They've been investigating this issue in partnership, and they join us now in the regional roundup. Bob is in studio with us. Good to have you here, Bob.
Thanks, Mary.
And Charlotte, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
So let's begin by getting a little more history of the school itself. Bob, to you first. Describe the vision of Milton and Catherine Hershey when they founded this school 111 years ago, and describe for us how that vision has expanded since it was first an orphanage.
Yeah, there's a lot of history here. Milton and Catherine, they didn't have kids, and they wrote this deed in 1909 in which they established an orphanage and trade school for male orphans, just white boys. And over time, through a series of, it began with 460 acres of land, and then in 1918, Milton put basically all his business interests into this charitable trust, which means the beneficiaries would be orphans, white male orphans. And it existed that way until he died in 1945. So it's a legal entity. The beneficiaries are initially white male orphans, and now it's expanded to children of color, whites, and you don't have to be an orphan. You just have to be a disadvantaged child.
At risk. Charlotte, decades later, the emphasis moved from farm work to academic. Do kids at the Hershey School tend to fare well on things like standardized testing?
Yes, they absolutely do. And many of the students that we interviewed mentioned how rigorous the school's academics were and how much they appreciated those kinds of things, as well as the other kinds of enrichment and extracurriculars that the school offers.
As you both report, most MHS grads, 4 out of 5, Charlotte, jump right into post-secondary education after graduating high school. What types of education are we talking about, and how do they generally fare here?
Well, the largest chunk of that is 4-year college, but that 4 out of 5 number includes, a 2-year college or like a kind of vocational training program. And experts that we spoke to said, it's really difficult to say how well graduates fare because the school is so unique that it's really hard to compare it to other institutions. Because on the one hand, the school serves only low-income children who, of course, overall tend to enter and finish college at much lower rates than average. And on the other hand, the school is highly selective and it only accepts children who meet its criteria. And it has these unparalleled resources to give them a really great education as well as money for college. And so we found that graduates of the school in recent years have finished college roughly under the national average, and administrators say that meeting the national average is their goal.
Bob Fernandez, let's talk about the school's high-stake scholarship program. How does it work? How do students get into it?
So when Hershey established this school through his deed, he was very clear he wanted children, both to boys, to work on his farms, and it was a time where you could sort of work off your charity. The law allowed you to do that, and he said in the deed that he wanted them to learn skills. He wanted them to be able to support themselves once they at 18 when they left the school, because he didn't say this in the deed, but through what sort of understood is he believed that they needed to work make money right out the door, and they could go to college later if they had the drive and they had the intelligence and they had the support. Somewhere around the, over time, as the economy professionalized and the white-collar jobs became more prevalent, I think the trade school aspect of it sort of declined. Yeah. And then in the 90s, they sort of moved away and even closed the trade shops. But you needed to recruit. You needed to have, you needed to have the children break the cycle of poverty, and college was going to be the path. And so somewhere around 2000, 20 years ago, they began, they began this scholarship program. Even though in the past, I think that they would pay for college for graduates that were smart enough that could go. They sort of formalized the scholarship program around 2000, and what we found through our reporting was that they have so they've tinkered with it, trying to make it successful, because it's very unusual to have a residential school for poor children in which you try to get them through college. It's kind of like a boarding school for, it's like Andover for disadvantaged children or something. And so they began somewhere around, I don't know, 2006, 2007, you know, basically saying if you succeed at the school, you can earn such and such amount in a scholarship.
Okay.
You need to have grades and you need to behave well. And then in 2011, I think that they were still having trouble with the graduates completing college. They began this began saying that you needed to take out these loans, these federal loans, $2,500 a year. And then after you get the loans, you can access your scholarship.
So what would happen was if a student could not make it through all 2 or 4 years of college, whichever path they chose, if they had the scholarships and they had the scholarship money, but they also had the federal loan money, they would have to pay those federal loans back if they couldn't complete their course of study. If they completed the course of study, they didn't have to pay the loans back. Is that how it works, Charlotte?
Yes, that's right.
Okay.
And it's kind of an unusual combination because the scholarship money that graduates can access is extraordinarily generous compared to other scholarship programs. It's currently up to $95,000. That's just, it's so unusual for high school students to be able to have that kind of money for college. And at the same time, before students can access that money, they have to take out these relatively small federal loans. And what we found when we asked experts about this was that they said pretty much uniformly that this was a very unusual and kind of risky approach, because even though $2,500 a year doesn't seem like a huge amount of money compared to how much some students borrow for college, actually the biggest predictor of whether a borrower will default on their student loans is whether or not they finish post-secondary education.
Yeah.
And so a system where students who drop out have to pay the loans back kind of doubles down on that dynamic and means that students are left with these debts. And actually, the highest default rates among federal student loan borrowers are among those who owe less than $5,000.
Yeah.
And so definitely we found among students that we interviewed, a number of them had defaulted on those loans and were dealing with, you know, all the negative financial consequences that that brings.
So let's talk about one of those, the former Milton Hershey School students, Deshaun Carroll. And again, when you come from a background which is low income, even a small loan, defaulting on a small loan, can be a huge challenge. Tell us about his experience, Charlotte.
Sure. So Deshaun was one of the members of the graduating class of 2011, the first year that students were required to take out these loans. And so we interviewed a number of members of this class because we were just really interested to understand more about how they had experienced that. And for Deshaun, he, after graduating from Milton Hershey, he enrolled at the Harrisburg Area Community College, and he took out a federal loan in order to use his scholarship money. And pretty quickly, he began to have problems. He often didn't have money to pay for the bus, and so he would walk to school and end up being late. And he ended up dropping out because he was failing several classes by the end of the first semester. And he said that looking back, he really didn't understand the responsibility that he had taken on with that federal loan. And he didn't realize that not paying it back would have really negative financial consequences that he is still dealing with today, almost 10 years later.
We do have a response from the Milton Hershey School. We have reached out to them for this program. So let me read the response. Our commitment to students and graduates is unparalleled, investing over $90,000 per student annually for academics, healthcare, food and clothing, dental and psychological services before they graduate. Students spend their senior year living independently in a dormitory setting under supervision of MHS staff to learn budgeting and other skills necessary after they graduate. Each graduate has a detailed plan and a support specialist to accompany their voluntary scholarship to cover tuition, living expenses, healthcare, transportation, and personal needs. Up to 88% of MHS graduates take advantage of the access to college that MHS provides, compared to 33% of low-income peers who attend college nationally. 70% graduate debt-free. The rest have an average debt 1/10 the national average. We work diligently to help our adult alumni, but do need a personal commitment. While every graduate is important to us and we continue to counsel as long as they are receptive, they need to willingly participate and respond to our outreach and guidance. So again, Deshaun Carroll didn't feel apparently that he had been prepared well enough. But, you know, Bob Fernandez, you know, according to what the school is saying, is it your take that students did get the opportunity to understand the conditions of the loan program thoroughly and the consequences of not being able to keep up? What is your take on this?
I don't think that the class of 2011 understood the consequences of it. They had actually gone through, when you go through your high school years, you basically earn your scholarship, a percentage of it each year. So they had actually thought that they had earned it. And then all of a sudden they were told in 2011, you got to take out this loan first to access it. So I don't believe that they thought that they understood it. I don't think when you're 18 years old, you understand the significance of credit scores and defaulting, you know, the inability to rent an apartment and debt collectors calling you. You know, and I think that the sophistication wasn't there or isn't there. It doesn't seem to make sense to me. Anyway, makes sense. Look, there's a school that's got $1 billion in surplus assets. It's confusing as to why they would require these $2,500 loans.
And Charlotte, Deshaun asks, you know, if you have too much money, in his words, why are kids taking out loans? Do you see any movement from the school to reconsider this policy in regards to the concern of former students?
I mean, not really so far. I have to say, when in an interview we asked administrators about this, they said that they had not heard complaints from students about the loan requirement. I think one thing that it is worth noting is that we tried really hard to understand why the school made the decision to put this loan requirement in place and whether their argument that it would, in their words, give students, you know, a greater commitment to their education, whether that argument kind of makes sense. And they did at one point refer us to a scholarly paper that they said supported their decision on this. But when we interviewed the researcher who wrote that paper, she actually really disagreed with the school's interpretation of it and said they were misunderstanding her work.
All right, let me pause for a station ID. You are listening to the Regional Roundup on WHYY in Philadelphia. Thanks for that, Charlotte. Please continue.
Oh, so I was just going to say, I think it's something that clearly the school feels is important, and it kind of ties into a broader culture of personal accountability and the importance of that at the school and afterwards. But it's certainly not something that experts we spoke to considered mainstream or kind of a good idea.
And to be fair, there are, you know, some student success stories in the scholarship program. Bob, you spoke with Anna Morhefka, is that her name, who graduated from Edinburgh University in 2018?
There are success stories. Charlotte spoke with her.
Okay. Charlotte, we'll toss that to you.
Yeah, absolutely. There are many, many success stories. And it's, you know, for Anna, she really, I think, exemplifies the way that the scholarship program is supposed to work, that she was able to have her federal loans paid back in full because she completed her program. So she was able to earn a bachelor's degree debt-free. She went on to earn a master's degree, and she now is a social worker. And she said that, you know, the school was life-changing for her, and the scholarship program was just an incredible opportunity. So it's absolutely not that there aren't success stories, because there are, and they're very widespread. It's more that this kind of policy in particular has risks, and for some students, when they aren't able to complete and they are left with those loans and they struggle with them, that downside is very clear.
Let's get into how the Hershey School is managed and oversight. As you report, When both Milton and Catherine had passed away, control of the Hershey Company and what was at the time the orphanage went to people on the board of Hershey's Bank who elect themselves to these positions, and they're also members of the school board. Bob, all of this seems a little close for comfort.
It is. So, I mean, on their own 990, which is the tax form that a charity like this files, a nonprofit, they acknowledge that they have no independent board members because they're all paid a minimum of $110,000 a year. The board is mostly comprised of there's four alumni. There are some formal, I would say, people who are powerful or connected politically in Pennsylvania. And there are like two education experts. But it's a board that's, it's been investigated in the past.
Relatively little government oversight, but by the state attorney general's office twice.
Yes.
Yeah. And so as observers, and I'm going to throw this to you, Charlotte, first, if we have time to get both. But as observers, do you think the school is fulfilling its mission in the spirit of the original intent of Milton and Catherine Hershey?
Well, I think that's a really complicated question because while on the one hand, you know, legally speaking, the school is bound by the terms of the deed as written by Milton and Catherine in 1909, clearly there are many aspects of that that have changed and that aren't necessarily applicable to the modern world. And so the school is kind of, there's some tension there between, you know, sticking to what is in the original deed and some of those restrictions and changing those, making it more flexible so that the school can adjust to the 21st century. And so I think we've tried to kind of depict that tension in these stories that, you know, the school is in some ways a cutting edge modern educational institution and in other ways, still bound by these very old restrictions that in some ways, create obstacles to it doing more to fulfill its mission.
All right, Charlotte Keith, we're up against the clock. Thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate you joining us here on the Regional Roundup. Charlotte is a reporter with Spotlight Pennsylvania. And Bob Fernandez, same to you, reports for the Philadelphia Inquirer. The series is a series of investigative articles detailing finances at the Milton Hershey School. Stay with us.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, and this is the Regional Roundup. Few would disagree that Philadelphia is in a league of its own when it comes to sports, from its long-suffering and notoriously demonstrative fans to the colorful stars, coaches, teams, and the occasional stunning championship. There are a million unforgettable stories in this scrappy sports town. Ray Dinger has had a front row seat to a great many of them since the 1970s as a sports writer, Emmy Award-winning film producer, broadcast analyst, playwright, and author. His latest book is called Finished Business, My 50 Years of Headlines, Heroes, and Heartaches. And Ray joins us now in studio to share some of these stories with us. So good to have you back with us.
Good to be back, Mary.
Well, I have to say, I absolutely loved this book.
Thank you.
Such a great read. And before we get to it, of course, we have to just take kind of a little bit of a left turn and acknowledge the Sixers lost last night. 103-96. They just can't seem to get past the second round in the postseason for the past few years. Quick question for you. Was the process a failure?
Yeah.
Yeah.
to cut to the chase, yeah. I mean, everyone knows what the process stands for. It was the Sixers went through a period of 4 years in a row where they deliberately tried to build the worst team in football, worst team in basketball, yeah, so that they could get a high draft pick each of those years and build a super team that would come out of that and rule the NBA for the better part of a decade. Well,
yeah.
They certainly succeeded in the first part. They developed the bad team that lost a lot of games, and they got those high draft picks. But they have nothing to show for it now. They have Joel Embiid, who's one of the best players in the NBA, but right now you get to the playoffs and he's pretty much playing by himself.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, yeah, the question now asks, there's always been kind of this waiting period. Well, maybe next year, maybe next year. But when you do what they did, there is no next year. You have to do it like right now. And I think last night it all came to a – I think we all saw it come to an end. And now they just have to move on.
All right. Well, stay tuned. We'll be watching that, right? Let's get to football.
Okay.
When we talk about, I should say, the absolute pinnacle for the Eagles, it was, of course, Super Bowl 52. Doug Peterson will always be the coach who brought the Vince Lombardi Trophy home to Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. But Dick Vermeil, you write about Vermeil. He got them to Super Bowl 15 after the Eagles suffered through many lousy years.
Sure.
You tell the story of how Vermeil got here, and it's an interesting story. It's a colorful story. It's got Leonard Toews, the former owner, who had a whole lot of baggage attached to him. Did Vermeil want to come to Philly at first? What was he doing at the time?
Well, he was coaching at UCLA. He was the head coach at UCLA, and young coach, still in his 30s. And UCLA had a good team, not a great team, and they got to the Rose Bowl that year. Where they met up with Ohio State, who were undefeated, had the only two-time Heisman Trophy winner in the history of college football, Archie Griffin. They were considered perhaps the greatest college football team of all time. So when they went out to play UCLA in the Rose Bowl, everyone just assumed that they were just going to crush UCLA. They had played them earlier in the year and beaten them handily, and they thought this was just going to be the same thing. And they get to the Rose Bowl game, and Vermeil coached a brilliant game, had his team really ready to play. And they came out and they knocked off Ohio State and beat them pretty handily, actually. But how this all ties into Philadelphia was the Eagles had just fired their head coach, Mike McCormick, and Leonard Toews, who was the owner, was watching the Rose Bowl, was flipping around to all the bowl games with his general manager, Jim Murray. And they flip over to the Rose Bowl, and they say, my goodness, look at this, UCLA is beating Ohio State. And just at that moment, the camera cut to a close-up of Dick Vermeil on the sidelines.
This boyishly handsome guy.
Boyishly handsome. Yeah. And as Jim Murray described it, he looked like Robert Redford and coached like General Patton. And Leonard Toews had no idea who he was. He just said, who's that? And Jim Murray said, well, that's Dick Vermeil. He's the coach of UCLA. And Leonard Toews said, let's go talk to that guy.
And so when Vermeil meets with Toews and Murray, he mentions Philly sports fans, doesn't he?
Yes. Well,
a little concerned about them?
Oh, sure. Well, Dick had coached he was a California native, coached high school football, coached college football, coached 1 year with the Los Angeles Rams. He had never been out of California, really. But he had obviously watched football on television. And one of the games the previous year, the Rams had come to Philadelphia and played the Eagles at Veterans Stadium and beat them 42-3 on Monday Night Football, national audience. Mm. Total embarrassment. Rams crushed the Eagles. And the fans were marching around the stands carrying dog bones because they thought the team was a bunch of dogs. They were throwing golf balls from the upper deck.
My goodness.
And so Dick Vermeil sitting home watching this and thinking, my God, who would ever want to coach in a place like that? And lo and behold, who turns up on his doorstep but Leonard Toews offering him the opportunity to coach football in Philadelphia.
Yeah.
And Vermeil said to him, why would I want to come and coach at a place like that? And Jim Murray, who is a magnificent salesman, especially when he's trying to sell Philadelphia, his hometown, said, what you're seeing there is just the passion of a fan base that is starved for success. And what he said to him was, he said two things. He said, number one, these people are so desperate to win. You won't get a standing ovation if you win the coin toss. That's number one. But number two, he said, I really believe that if you come to Philadelphia, you will never leave.
Which
turned out to be true.
Yeah.
I mean, he came to Philadelphia, became enormously popular, coached the Eagles through 82, retired, went into broadcasting, came back as a coach, won a Super Bowl with the St. Louis Rams, but never left Philadelphia and still hasn't. And still, you see his face on billboards all over the city. He is as much a Philly guy as anybody that's ever been born in Philadelphia.
Yeah, and you tell a great story about when Leonard Toews, who was, among other things, he was a high-risk, high-stakes gambler, and he lost everything.
Everything.
But Vermeil, who by then was out of the picture in Philadelphia as far as being a coach was concerned, mm-hmm. right, he quietly stepped in to help.
Yeah, he did. Leonard lost everything, lost his house and a sheriff's sale. It's hard to believe someone who had the means and the wealth that Leonard Toews did could find himself literally evicted from his house, but he did. And would have been literally out on the street, except Dick Vermeil stepped in. He was representing Blue Cross Blue Shield at the time, so he made sure through Blue Cross Blue Shield that Leonard Toews had all of his medical coverage intact. And he found him a place to live. He got him a place at the Warwick Hotel right off Rittenhouse Square. So he got him a place to live, and then Dick would just send him money all the time to support him. And Dick never wanted that to get out. He never wanted people to know that, because at that point in Leonard's life, the only thing he really had left was his dignity, and Dick didn't want him to lose that. But, of course, it's hard to keep a secret like that. It gets out. Yeah. And Dick always regretted that it did, and he said, you know, this people wanted to make it like charity, and he said it wasn't charity. It was just a friend repaying a debt. He said, and I always remember Dick said, Leonard Toews gave me more than I could ever give him.
Yeah, they never got, they didn't get along all the time.
No.
As a matter of fact, Toews was devastated when Vermeil, you know, when they lost Super Bowl 50.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, no one ever got along with Leonard all the time. And that's why he was married four times. And, you know, he and I covered that team for the Philadelphia Bullet, and then he and I didn't get along all the time. Sometimes we did, sometimes we didn't. Yeah. But Leonard was a very mercurial person, and those were the nature of his relationships. But he and Dick remained friends, and no one could have taken better care of Leonard Toews through his life than Dick Vermeil did. But he's an extraordinary person.
Yeah. Let's turn to hockey, Ray. As you write, in the early 1970s, the sports landscape was as bleak and arid as the Sahara. Mm-hmm. The Flyers were still a relatively young team and perhaps not so good. But all this changed in 1973. Could you read a passage for us?
Sure. The Flyers assembled a feisty young team that became known as the Broad Street Bullies, led by a gap-toothed captain named Bobby Clark and a superb goaltender in Bernie Parent. The Philadelphia Flyers stunned the hockey world by winning the Stanley Cup in only their seventh season. But it wasn't just the winning. It was how they won that captured the heart of Philadelphia. They didn't just outscore the opposition. They outhit them, and they outfought them. They won back-to-back Stanley Cups, leaving a trail of blackened eyes and bloody noses in their wake.
Before this, they'd been a talented group of guys, but they were physically being pushed around by other teams in the NHL. As you write, Bobby Clark's blonde curls made him look like an innocent schoolboy, but when he was playing in the 1972 Summit Series, he took out the Soviets' best player,
Valery Karlamov, who was really dominating the series, and the Soviet team, which no one really fully appreciated how great the Soviet hockey team was, and they were playing this team of NHL All-Stars, and everyone assumed that the NHL All-Stars would just walk through the Soviet team, and they did not. The Soviets were winning the series, and Karlamov was their best player. And Bobby Clark just felt like, well, the only way we're going to turn this series around is we get Karlamov off the ice. And Bobby took his stick and just whacked Karlamov across the ankle, broke his ankle. Mm. And as Bobby says later, and I quote him in the book, he said, look, I'm not proud of doing what I did, but I'm not going to apologize for it either. Because without Karlamov, the Soviet team wasn't as good. Canada came back, turned the series around, and wound up winning Game 8, the deciding game, in Moscow.
Hmm. So, and today, hockey is, you know, to this day, a game of missing teeth. But is it the kind of no-holds-barred game it was almost 50 years ago?
Oh, no, much different. Hmm. The professional hockey, the National Hockey League, totally different game now. The Broad Street Bullies is such a different era now. It's almost hard for someone who lived through it, as I did and wrote about it. I watched the NHL today, and it's not even the same game. There's very little fighting now. Teams don't have – back in those days, every team had two or three guys on the team that weren't particularly skilled players but were just there for the rough stuff. The Flyers just had more than most. It's unfair to say that they won because they fought. It's unfair that they say that they won because they were brutes and they were savages. They had great players. Clark was a great player. Bernie Parent was the best goaltender in hockey. Bill Barber is a Hall of Famer. Their coach, Fred Shiro, was in many ways ahead of his time in terms of strategy and using game film the way football coaches do. Yeah. So, there was a lot more to the Flyers than just the fisticuffs, but yeah. It would be disingenuous to suggest that the fisticuffs didn't have something to do with it.
And yet people keep harking back to the Broad Street Bullies. Of course, that's the last time they won, you know, a Stanley Cup.
They won it back to back. Yes, they won it back to back, and they haven't won it since. And that's and the interesting thing about that team is so many of them have stayed in Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. If you go to a Flyers game now, It's hard to turn the corner without bumping into one of those guys because they're all still here. Even though they're all Canadian and even though most of them finished their careers elsewhere, they all made Philadelphia their home, and it's still their home today.
Back to football for a moment. Just briefly about the Vet. It was supposed to be the stadium of the future back when the Eagles took residence in 71. You wrote about it. It turned out to be so bizarrely bad that the Eagles considered canceling their first game there.
Yes. Well, that was the first time. Back in 1971, 72, everybody thought that that kind of a stadium was the wave of the future. Yeah. You know, the shared by baseball and football, artificial turf, circular construction. But it was actually a terrible idea. It just took people a while to figure it out. But the Vet was the worst of the worst. And the turf, when they had to convert from a baseball field to a football field, and they would lay that AstroTurf over the base cutouts and everything, there were these soft spots, there were these ridges, there were bumps. It was just terrible.
Oh, my goodness.
The night before the very first game, it was supposed to be an Eagles exhibition game against the Buffalo Bills, who then had O.J. Simpson. And the Eagles had their first practice the night before the game. And the general manager was walking on the field and dragged me out on the field to show me how bad it was. And we walked to the 15-yard line, and he said, "Look at this." And he put his foot down, and his foot disappeared.
Who designed this?
That's how deep the hole was.
Who designed this?
It wasn't really a matter of the architects. What it really was it was a city-run stadium.
Yeah.
So the people that were taking care of the fields were city employees. They weren't employees of the Eagles.
Yeah.
And city workers are city workers, you know. And they didn't particularly care one way or the other. But, I mean, it was so bad that the general manager, Pete Retzlaff, actually went to Leonard Toews and said, "We have to cancel the game tomorrow. This field is unplayable." And, of course, Toews said, "The first game, we're canceling?" No, that is not happening. Tell those guys to work all night if they have to. But we're playing the game tomorrow, and they did.
Yeah. Well, thankfully, the Super Bowl 52 gang did not have to deal with that. You know,
no.
they had the link. Tough to define chemistry, Ray, but you knew it when you saw it. Before Doug Peterson was hired as head coach, you were on the radio, and this was a search, you know, for the coach after Chip Kelly was canned. When a caller suggested Peterson would be the Eagles' choice to succeed Kelly, and you laughed?
I laughed. I laughed because the Eagles were looking around for a coach, and a lot of people had been interviewed, and a lot of people had been talked about, and we were taking phone calls, and a gentleman called from Kansas City and said, "I'm going to tell you right now who your next coach is going to be." And, okay. And he said, "Doug Peterson." And my response was, I laughed.
You're listening to the Regional Roundup on WHYY in Philadelphia. So just before Super Bowl 52, you had the stats on the Patriot on paper, or the Patriots rather, on paper, they were the better team. But you did have a feeling. You had a feeling about that game.
Oh, I predicted the Eagles were going to win. But even though, and I'm generally a statistically driven person, I kind of go where the evidence is. I don't go by gut very much.
Yeah.
And to me, you stacked up all the stats, and the Patriots should have won the game handily. But I just had a feeling about that Eagles team. I had a feeling it was their year. I mean, I couldn't really defend it statistically. You know, you look at all the X's and O's reasons of why teams win games. I couldn't point to a single one and said the Eagles are better here. But they had just played. They had so overachieved that year. They had overcome so much, losing their quarterback, losing a bunch of their star players.
Yeah.
They were underdogs in every playoff game, but they kept winning. And I just felt they really believed. Remember they were going around wearing dog masks and things?
Yeah. Who could forget?
And, I mean, it was sort of a goof, and people laughed at it. But it took on
a certain
weight.
Energy.
I mean, the guys really believed it.
Yeah.
And I just felt like, and it was so perfect that it was the Patriots. You know, the team that they still wanted to get back at, that they had lost the previous Super Bowl to them. Everything, to me, it just set up perfectly for them to have one last surprise. Mm-hmm. And they pulled it on everybody. And really, I think it's one of the great Super Bowls ever played, if not the best. It was memorable in every way. I mean, Philadelphia will never let go of it. But just a pure football fan, a pure football game, it was a great one.
Yeah. We've got about 10 seconds. What went through your mind when you looked at the scoreboard and saw 41-33? That was it.
Didn't believe it. Didn't quite believe it. I really needed to see the color of the confetti that was falling. When I saw that it was green and silver, I finally believed. I kept thinking it was going to come out red and blue. But when it came out green and silver, I thought, you know what? They've really done it.
Well, Ray Didinger, so much fun to have you with us again, and we'll talk soon again, hopefully.
I hope we do. Thanks, Mary.
Ray's latest book is Finished Business, My 50 Years of Headlines, Heroes, and Heartaches. Our engineer today has been Adam Staniszewski, our producer, Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. As always, thanks for listening, and be well.